Mike.
Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, I found it interesting. Yeah, it's good to have a sort of historical talk. We don't seem to sort of get quite enough of those. And yeah, well done as well for battling through if you've been under the weather lately. It was more of a question really than a point. I suppose when you're talking about the mass support for that movement in London with thousands of people likely all sort of rallying together. That made me wonder how sort of information was spread at that time. Presumably writing would have been sort of quite limited. I'm imagining some sort of town crier type way of spreading news and information among the masses. And so yeah, I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about how sort of people sort of found out about what was going on and in a sort of a practical way and how that might have sort of influenced the sort of prevailing thought, because presumably any kind of information going about would have had its own bias and slant based on whatever information coming from whichever direction. So I suppose the question there is, to what extent was that information sort of propaganda on whatever side, and how you think that influenced the way these sort of political sort of movements moved. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, cheers.
That's actually a truly excellent question. Pardon me. Partly the aldermen. So one of the things that they were expected to do was to go to their parish, to go to their wards, and they would stand there, and this is oral culture, they would promulgate the latest declarations of the king, the latest decisions of whoever. So and also so it is, and there was actually quite an extensive system of local government. That's a separate book that I've got somewhere which I haven't looked at for a while. So, but this is what I mean about political sophistication. Just because there's no writing, and in fact, there is an argument. Apparently, I came across something tangentially of a suspicion of writing, the oral culture, because in an oral culture, you can subtly change the arrangement. You can accommodate people, but when something's written down, someone else can take control of the discussion because they can say it's in writing, and this is what it means, and this is where you get that lawfare going on at a kind of different level. And this is where the agreements are written down. So among the common folk, my word is my bond, and if you're living in that sort of oral culture, that's how the information gets out there. And of course, one of the other things that is this is why is. Part of the background to this, reading up on this subject, was I came across a university project where they were looking at the because the folk moot of London, of course, there's moots everywhere, and they were quite a powerful force and a political force. So the whole sort of like Monty Python, the peasants because they're covered in shit. No, the peasants were part and parcel and actively engaged in sophisticated elements of the government and governance. So it was it, there's a, and that's why the king obviously was able to appropriate the folk moot, because the existing structures were there for that particular passing of information along. And yeah, I mean that, and a bit later on, the peasants' revolt shows how people could organize fairly quickly and rapidly when they needed to. Howard, you are next. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks very much. Almost as much strife there as Britain under Labour. That's sort of said half tongue in cheek, but good God, I mean, we've got a member in our branch who has stopped listening up to the news on the radio, watching it on television. He can't stand it. It's so bad. It's so depressing. People shouting at one another, killing one another, etc. Not just in Britain, obviously throughout the whole world of capitalism. But as you were speaking, it just reminded me of all the multiple sort of quarrels going on everywhere in the world. Some violent, some less violent. But really, the system that's come into being after the system that you're describing is, well, I won't say just as bad, it's heaps worse in so many ways, but really, you know, it's evidence that we do need to do something radically different of the kind that we advocate, rather than the stuff that's gone before and the stuff that's happening now. That's a bit of a non-point, but I can't not make it.
No, it is interesting. I mean, partly because this model of revolution, which is in everyone's heads, you know, as I say, this going back 800 odd years, that's how people think a revolution looks. That there'll be someone out on the streets. There'll be militias everywhere. I mean, we have to say that, you know, one of the reasons why I have a big hate on for Game of Thrones is that for 90% of peasants, none of this is happening. You know, people were living long, happy lives, punctuated by these outbursts of violence, and with this complex political arrangements that they were able to make. But obviously this is a period I'm describing of a breakdown in what was the previous arrangement. But obviously, yes, and again, that violence and warfare was a central part of, it wasn't something it bolted on. It was the way that the economy worked, because it was ruled by a military caste. And I think someone, David Graeber, says that modern capitalism is an alliance between the merchants and the military, because they were able to sort of like bring peace at home and then export the violence around the world. But yes, in some ways, you know, virulent disagreement can be a good thing in its own way. But yes, perhaps we could even arguably the political skills of a medieval peasant were greater than some of the ones that we're seeing at the moment. Paddy.
Thanks for that, Bill. I'm almost ashamed to admit I love all this stuff, Game of Thrones or not, the nasty Plantagenets and the things they got up to. I got a bit thrown because you did mention Richard II a couple of times. It was actually Richard I in 1190. Richard II was about 200 years later and crushed the Peasants' Revolt, among other things. What Mike was asking about communication, and you mentioned about aldermen, I think that probably applied to London, but in the countryside, from my understanding, is that 90% of the people lived in the countryside and wouldn't even know if there'd been a war or a new king on the throne. They just wouldn't know. And this is the role of minstrels in that particular period. The minstrels, these sort of roving bands of minstrels, they were called jongleurs in France because they also juggled, because they were entertainers, and they would make up songs and they'd go from town to town, village to village, you know, singing their songs, juggling, doing party tricks and stuff like that. And then the locals would give them a big slap up dinner for their pains, and also learn what had been going on in the land. So they were the sort of medieval internet at the time. So I think that was what I was going to say. One other thing I was going to ask. Our Thursday group, we did a study of Ellen Makesin's Wood, Origins of Capitalism. I don't know what you think about this. She says two things that I think are really interesting. For a start, you started by talking about the bourgeois, you know, the bourgeoisie. She says, well, the thinking now is that capitalism didn't start in towns at all. It started in the countryside. And the other point related to this is that it started particularly in the English countryside, because the Normans had brought in their custom, unlike the Saxons. The Normans had introduced their custom of primogeniture into England, which held the largest states together. Unlike other countries in Europe, where they spread the inheritances were split between all the kids. So in England, all the larger states were held together, and this was what was able to kickstart the enclosures and then you know, the capitalist system of production, which wasn't. It was much harder to do that in countries where all the land was parcelled off in. Under different owners. I thought that was really kind of interesting. I was wondering if you had a take on that. Thanks.
Well, I think I was stretching my memory back. I think when I was talking about Edward I and the need for wool, I think I was lifting something I read in that book, I think. or something by her. So you've scratched a memory there. So I mean, it would certainly be of a par. The need for kings to get money and through large estates and through the growth of wool markets and sheep production, that would make sense. Yes, so the merchants are a key part of that, because obviously eventually you need to get them circulating, and the kings themselves are driving forward the creation of towns to get money. So there's this element of that circuit of that they're driving the thing that breaks down. Because one of the other things, I mean, I left off that I think when I was talking about the massacre of the Jews, was one of the things that was going on at the time, which was really riling the aristocracy, was that people indebted to some of the aristocrats indebted to Jews were losing some of their estates because they couldn't pay their debts. And eventually, I think the king was getting them or something like that. But it was breaking down this system of relations being between people, and it was the start of the early commodification. And just in terms of, I mean, London had the folk movement, but every county was divided into hundreds, except for Yorkshire, which was divided into wapentakes, and Sussex, which for some reason is divided into rapes. But I assume that means it, as in Norman French, to take. But you each hundred would have a moot site where people would go three or four times a year, 10 miles walk from their home. So this is what I mean about, you know, you need to start thinking about this sort of political culture. Then you've got the justices going on air, doing the circuits. And messages from the king were getting out fairly cohesively. I mean, it's moving at the speed of foot and horse, but the messages would get out there, and there was a surprising amount of capacity to organise, because obviously people don't have much else to do except spread news, I suppose, whenever they see someone. Yes. I'll hold on to that thought about breakdown of feudal relations if the conversation dies down a little bit. Adam.
Yeah, well, you've already introduced what I was going to ask about. What language were these people speaking? Because, well, you're talking about a period of, 100, 200 years after the Norman conquest. As you just pointed out, the Norman barons presumably spoke Norman French, and in fact, the names of the people, three people you mentioned, was it Fitz Osborne, Fitz Thomas, and Dilys? They sound as if they're speaking Norman French, or at least from families that speak Norman French. And you, at the beginning, you were talking about preferring the word commons, but the House of Commons, of course, is the House of Communes. That's its name now. Even in modern French, it's the Chambre des Communes. So, but on the other hand, you talk about folk moot. So, I mean, some people presumably were still speaking Anglo-Saxon, but the people you're talking about, what language were they speaking? I think the aristocracy were all speaking the king, or were all speaking French as well. Would that be right?
Yeah. So the king would have been speaking French. I think that this is the time when courts, I think around this, I've got my timelines, it's either around this time or at the end of this century that English courts start speaking English. And I think that the House of Commons starts speaking in English. So we're very near that time. So there's still, the common people, commoners, and you're right, House of Communes, that's why, because the London was a commune. I was wanting to make that link between communes and common and that sort of thing. They would have been speaking Middle English, which is English that's picked up a lot of French words. So we're only 100 years away from Chaucer, which is why I kind of threatened a follow-up talk on Canterbury Tales. But most people, and I would have thought that Twain would speak English. He might be a Norman knight. He could be, I don't know where, the Twing family. Twing is a village near Scarborough. It's in the East Riding. But yes, so De Stepney, Fitzosbert and all this sort of thing. Clearly, they're living in a society where the aristocracy and the really top people are speaking French or Norman French. Howard.
On that same subject, Bill, isn't it a bit of a miracle that English actually survived, given the number of Normans who came up and given the fact that they were, as it were, the top dogs? In such circumstances, in other parts of the world, it's been the, you know, the invading language which has eventually taken over, which would, of course, have led to the situation where today we'd always speak in French and not English, which would probably be difficult for some of us. I don't know. What's your take on that?
Oh, it's an entirely different talk. I mean, if you compare, if you look at Old English, I mean, if you read out a bit of Old English, the pre-Norman stuff, you can just about understand some words here and there, but it's so wildly different. And I think an Old English person would think that we are speaking French. So much of our language is Latinate, and has been taken from the French and certain French formations. There's some interesting questions about what we call English, because what happened to the Brythonic languages and the Brythonic peoples when the Saxons were moving in? It's very hard to work out. Either they interbred or they killed them all. We don't quite know. I think the idea is that there was so many English that there wasn't a war of extermination. The Normans ruled, but the English remained. And they remain fairly cohesive. But in some parts, I think I missed off. I think there was part of the revolt in London was about the function of Gascon merchants, and the king was favouring certain merchants from Gascony, and the merchants of London were resenting that. So there is some elements of nativism at the back of all of this story. I thoroughly recommend people to read about it. I was just looking at a web video. The word dog is one of these words. It's a bit of a mystery because it doesn't exist in any morphological sense in any other language. And it suddenly emerges around about this time in writing, the time we're talking about, as English emerges as a written language again. And the pet theory is that it actually... Because there's a couple of other words. There isn't, no, you know, hound would be the actual English word, but the suggestion is that it's actually a corruption of something like doggy. So it'd be hundog, and they've just dropped off. It was a familiar term like that that would not have been written down previously, but because it's become the dominant term, we've got this weird word that sticks out in the whole of Europe. And of course, there's the fact that the famous one that you get is that we eat ham and beef and pork, whereas we grow pigs and cows, cattle and sheep. And those last three are all English words, and beef, pork and ham are all French words. So the people who were producing the animals were calling it one thing. The people who were eating them were calling it something else.
Can I just say, Bill, that while it's true that there's a lot of French in the English that evolved and in the English that we speak today, it is mainly in the vocabulary, isn't it, rather than in the actual structure of the language? I mean, the structures of English remain... All right, they evolve themselves, but not... based on the fact that, you know, the vocabulary and so on, quite a lot of French vocabulary passed into the language. I mean, a lot more French vocabulary passed into English anyway, didn't it, in the 18th and 19th century? But,
the key parts of the grammar, although there is, always taking me back to seminars, you know, we've lost our subjunctive and all sorts of things, and it's no longer a declining, so we have to word order determines what words in a sentence mean much more than any suffixes and all this sort of thing. Like you, like you'd find in German where, you know, the verb moves around. But yes, it is substantially, you know, like I say, if you do Old English, study Old English, an awful lot has survived. And if you hear it, if you see it written down, it's impenetrable. But when someone starts to read it out, then you start to hear, you know, the words are kind of there, but not quite. And of course, I suppose it's another thing to point out that what we speak nowadays, there's something called the Great Vowel Shift, which happened around Shakespeare's time, where modern English became dominated by London English. So where, you know, people speak and receive pronunciation now would have a glass of wine in a bath. I'd have a glass of wine in the bath, because that vowel never made it that far north. And you could pick up similar sounds in Welsh or in Wales, in Anglophone Wales. But obviously different, because obviously they're sitting part and parcel with Welsh. Anyway, that's by the by. Anyone else got a hand?
Ray has put his hand up, Bill. Physically, I think.
All right.
Yeah. I don't know how to do it otherwise. Couple of questions, Bill. You're talking about the Norman language that they brought over with William the Conqueror. I'm just wondering, would there not be a lot of Scandinavian words in that? Because the Normans were descended from the Vikings who conquered the northern part of France 200 years before. I mean, Norman is a corruption of Norseman or Northman, man of the North. Would that not have been possible?
That's a bit outside my... I'm sure that there is some element of Northern French. I mean, you do hear a little bit of it when you go across France. I mean, I don't do it very often, but if you hear Southern French versus Northern French, I think there's a bit more of the trilling of the much more Latinate sound, you know, as you get towards the Italian border. So that there must be some elements of that, but I'm not an expert on Norman French, and of course there's bits of Norman in English, egg, hill, they're Norse words, and then there's so which is why we get up near Lancaster, there's a place called Pendle Hill, which is literally hill. So pen. From Brythonic, your Celtic languages, Dale, which is English, and Hill, which is Norse. So it's been, what's that? That's a hill. Oh, I'll call it Hill. So these have accreted over the years, but yes, is the short answer.
Just one other question. What year did the massacre of 500 Jews take place?
I think that's 1263. 1263.
I know that some attended the coronation of King Richard I bearing gifts, and he was very, very suspicious. Had some killed, and I know it was during his reign, a whole load were burned to death in the city of York. And this was a continuing thing. In 1348, the entire Jewish community of Mainz in Germany were all burned to death for refusing to convert to Christianity. And what was interesting, something Howard was saying about the barons murdering Jews because they owed them money and were fear of losing their lands to them. During the miners' strike in Wales, I think it was in the vicinity of 1910, Jewish shopkeepers had advanced striking miners' credit so they could feed their wives and children during the strike. And after the strike, that was when they tried to get into the places, the Jewish shops, and destroy their records, so they wouldn't have to pay them back any money. And that's when Churchill, of whom the least said the better, sent in the I don't know if it's the army or the Welsh constabulary to restore order.
Yes, I mean, you're quite right. I mean, it was not. It was on all sides. I mean, this is why I said it was a bigger topic, and it's a. In terms of anti-Semitisms, this is one species of the medieval version, and of course, Edward I famously expelled all the Jews finally from England, and that was until Cromwell's time when Cromwell allowed them to return. And Clifford's Tower in York, there was a massacre there. I think there were other massacres around this time as well. But it was it's a bigger topic because it's not as straightforward. And yes, I mean, apparently even the Duke of Cornwall, Henry's brother, I remember David Graeber in one of his books saying he was torturing Jews to try and get the money from them because he couldn't believe that they didn't have some more. So it's a horrific part. Well, in terms of the story I was telling tonight, it's part and parcel of this whole idea about extracting surplus and movable wealth, and which in terms leads to these sorts. Well, no, it doesn't lead to these sorts of massacres happened, and we have to acknowledge that because this is one of the reasons why I say that there's no heroes in this story, because everyone's eventually out to advance their own interests rather than some sort of general human interest. Richard.
Oh, hi, yeah. Bill, really enjoyed that. Thanks very much. That really kind of hit the spot, actually. And just since we got onto the language thing, just very, very briefly in response to Ray, the language of the north of England and the language of the south of England around the 13th up to 14th century was completely different, and because of the Norse influence on the northeast in particular, and over to on the northwest, etc. So if you compare someone like the language of Chaucer, which was the language of London, which was a kind of broadly Anglo-Saxon base infused with a lot of Romance, French, Norman French words, completely different up north. So if you compare Chaucer with somebody like the Gawain poet, who wrote Gawain and the Green Knight and Burning Bright and Pearl and all those kind of poems, language is totally different. You can actually understand Chaucer or a bit of Chaucer today, even because of the French influence. But if you read the Gawain poet, much, much more difficult to actually understand. So there was a huge difference in the language north and south because of the additional Norse influence from Norway in the northeast. Yeah, that's all I wanted to say.
Can't follow that. Thank you. Any more? Anyone else?
Only what John Ames, some of you may know him. I think he spent some time in England, and he was for a time the secretary of the Socialist Party of Canada. He told me, he's from Yorkshire, and he told me his time there were villages in Yorkshire, little pockets here and there, where nobody could understand, like nobody from outside could understand what the heck they were talking about. So this kind of thing even still goes on today.
That's true. I mean, there's still bits of West Yorkshire that they haven't brought civilization to yet. The heavy wool areas. That's why, famously England or Britain has all these various regional accents and they are very strong. And of course, what mass communication has standardized and things like, I mean, as a distinction, my dad would read a book, I read a book, and so little things like that, they do stand out. But it's language is a changing thing all the time.
Yeah. Oh, there's a slip of the tongue there. I said John Ames, I meant John Ayres. And since I mentioned John Ames, just send you grief, you guys greetings from Canada.
Oh, wow.
That's it.
Yeah, it's not just, if I can come in, it's not just the accents, it's the whole dialects that have changed. And you say that the language is constantly changing, and of course it is, but it's actually remarkably, a lot of it has remarkably stayed the same. Like, for example, something was brought to my attention a little while ago, in the sort of Birmingham area, in the Brummie region, or at least in some regions around there, the pronoun she has been replaced with the pronoun her. Oh, will be coming out this evening. And for many years, this was assumed to be just an ungrammatical use of her. But in fact, it was recently discovered that, in fact, er was the Anglo-Saxon pronoun of the Anglo-Saxon tribe in the region at the time, which has survived up to the present day. So you get a lot of stuff like this in different parts of the country. And in the Northeast, it's actually, I mean, Northeast dialogues to this dialects to this day contain loads and loads and loads of words that we wouldn't use normally down south, because they do actually go back to the Norse origins or the Norse influence in northern dialogue, in dialects. So yeah, go on.
Yeah, I agree. There's things like Bairn, which, you know, are Bairn. And, you know, even pronouns is one of the funny ones, because, you know, I'd say gizit here. And I'm using the first person plural as a first person single, but it's very common. Very briefly, I think I did promise to. This is a bit of a tangent for fans of King Lear, but this was. I did want to keep this in for the discussion. So, one of the things I was recently reading, the origins of taxation. So again, this is linked to language, because in English, Old English, it was called freoff, and in Scotch it was called conveth. And you'd all, baronial lords would owe the king various duties. So they'd owe the duty to fight with the king, they'd owe the duty to maintain his roads and fortifications, and they owed this thing called freoff or conveth, which was to put the king up for a certain number of nights. So you've got this link between hospitality and the relationship to the king of I will give you certain numbers of goods, which gets supplanted by because it becomes easier to just give him money rather than giving him 300 sheep or whatever, because it's not just the king, it's put up the king and his whole entourage. So it's, you know, the idea of your freoff is you owe the king 3 nights living. That's something. So when you watch King Lear, and King Lear says, well, I'm going to stop ruling, and all you need to do now is me and my knights are going to come and visit and live in your castle for part of the year. What he's essentially saying is, I'm going to give up being king, but I'm still going to collect the taxes. But you can see this shift between the appropriation of things and it's and the eventual change towards the dissolution by money in the form of taxation. So I thought that was something that didn't fit into the talk, but I thought that was relevant to be brought up tonight. And I can see in chat that there's been some discussion about pens, which, yes, that's quite right. There's it can mean head, but presumably by association, a hill and a head. Yes, and there's lots of them, and in Cumbria and in Scotland, I think, as well, there's plenty of pens. I think officially I've gone on for long enough, because it was supposed to be until 9 o'clock, so unless anyone has anything burning, I will invite someone to read out what the next... Oh, Adam?
Yeah. I thought you were going to give us an illustration of what Anglo-Saxon sounded like. But anyway, next week it's me speaking on evolution and the God delusion. I thought we should have something religious, because it'd be the last one before Christmas. It's basically arguments against the Jesuits and the Jehovah's Witnesses about the origin of life and so on. So that's next week.
And which side are you on, Adam?
Hmm?
Which side are you on?
What? I think your Jehovah's Witnesses are better than the Jesuits. Anyway, because the Jehovah's Witnesses don't believe in life after death. They just believe you never die. Yeah. Anyway, so that's what's going to be next week. And then after that, I suppose we'll have a break for 2 weeks until January. Okay, well, thanks, Bill. And that's it.
Thanks very much, Bill. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Bill.
Thank you very much.